family here and had 17 children with the nephew of the man who owned her.
So join me, Nuala McGovern, on BBC OS, Conversations About Race in America, all after the latest BBC News.
Hello, I'm Tom Watts with the BBC News. The young democracy activist Joshua Wong has given a defiant speech pleading with the world to stand with Hong Kong after Beijing imposed a sweeping security law. Mr. Wong and two other prominent young activists were appearing in court to face charges of illegal assembly. Martin Yip reports.
The trio, all members of the now disbanded political group Demosisto, are charged with inciting and taking part in an unauthorized assembly outside Hong Kong's police headquarters last June. Agnes Chow pleaded guilty to both charges, while Joshua Wong and Long Yin Lam pleaded not guilty. Before attending the hearing, Joshua Wong urged supporters inside and outside of Hong Kong to stand up and fight against kowtowing to China. Governments in Beijing and Hong Kong have insisted the new national security law would not threaten free speech, but the city's public libraries have already pulled Joshua Wong's books off the shelf.
A Chinese professor, Xu Zhengrun, who is known for his outspoken criticism of the country's leadership, is said to have been detained in Beijing. Stephen McDonnell has the details.
Xu Zhengrun's friends say up to 20 officers arrived at the professor's home in Beijing to take him away. In recent years, the Tsinghua University legal scholar has been treading an ever more dangerous path, criticising the Mao-like cult of personality which has returned under China's current leader, Xi Jinping. Despite previously being placed under house arrest with threats of more serious retribution from the authorities, he wrote this year about ways the Communist Party leadership has been blocking the reporting of factual information about the coronavirus outbreak.
The Italian composer Ennio Morricone, who wrote hundreds of film scores, has died at the age of 91. Now hailed as the emperor of film music, Morricone became famous in the 1960s through his partnership with his school friend, the director Sergio Leone, who's known as the inventor of the spaghetti western. Quentin Somerville looks back at his life.
The mission? Cinema Paradiso. Once upon a time in the West, some of the 500 films scored by Ennio Morricone. But he's best known for his haunting music to The Good, the Bad and the Ugly. He died in Rome after complications following a fall. He was 91. His music helped define the spaghetti westerns of his school friend Sergio Leone, building tension around the sparse dialogue of the films, three of which starred Clint Eastwood. Mr. Eastwood presented him with a Lifetime Achievement Oscar in 2007. His second came in 2016 for Quentin Tarantino's bleak and bloody The Hateful Eight.
You're listening to the world news from the BBC. The border between Australia's biggest states is being closed after a spike of coronavirus cases in Victoria, which the authorities have described as a national issue that puts all Australians at risk. Travel from the state to New South Wales will cease on Tuesday night for the first time in 100 years. Most of the cases are on 9 public housing estates in the state capital, Melbourne. The future of the Open Skies Treaty will be discussed at a specially convened conference in Vienna today. The agreement, which came into force in 1992, allows short-notice overflights of more than 30 countries to monitor military activity. More details from our diplomatic correspondent, Jonathan Marcus.
There's no sign of a US change of heart, so the question now is, can the Open Skies Agreement survive in the absence of the Americans? Washington's NATO allies, most of whom do not have access to sophisticated intelligence satellites, share Washington's concerns about Russia's behaviour, but want the agreement to continue. Moscow denies that it's been limiting surveillance flights over its enclave of Kaliningrad and parts of Georgia. It's insisting that if the treaty is to continue, then it will require guarantees that America's allies will not share surveillance data with Washington.
Israel has launched a new spy satellite as it continues to build up its surveillance capabilities to monitor countries it deems hostile, Iran in particular. The Israeli Defense Minister Benny Gantz said technological superiority and intelligence capabilities were essential to national security. Reports in the Indian media say both Chinese and Indian forces have pulled back from the border in the northern Ladakh region. An Indian official said soldiers had withdrawn 2 kilometres and temporary structures set up by both sides had been removed in the Galwan area, where 20 Indian soldiers were killed in a confrontation last month. There has been no confirmation of the pullback from China. Both countries have overlapping border claims. BBC News.
Hello, I'm Nuala McGovern on the BBC World Service, and this is BBC OS, Conversations About Race in America. As discussions and actions continue about racial equality around the world, we bring together 3 African-American women to share the history of their ancestors after uncovering details of a long-lost relative's slavery.
Reality hits you hard. Because you now see that your ancestor was owned by somebody who had the gall to think that they could own a human being.
155 years after the end of slavery in the United States, the country continues to struggle with racism. After the death in May of George Floyd while being arrested by police officers, the U.S. has been forced once again to examine and respond to the treatment of black Americans in all aspects of society. It has sparked global protests, unrest, and conversations about human rights, race, and inequality. There is a sense that this time things are changing, including the momentum for police reform in the US, the toppling of historic statues, and the removal of what is seen as symbols of racism. And for us to understand the present, we must also understand the past. For the African American community, it's about centuries of prejudice, which began after their ancestors were torn from friends and family across Africa. According to the Transatlantic Slave Trade Database, 12.5 million Africans were shipped to South America, the Caribbean, and what was then called the New World. Though not an official holiday in the US, June 19th is now known as Juneteenth, or Emancipation Day, after an army general reached Texas on June 19th, 1865, to tell people that were enslaved there that they were free. At this point, I want to introduce you to 3 African-American women. They are Bernice Alexander Bennett, a blogger and radio host in Silver Spring, Maryland, Shonda Brooks, who is a therapist in New Jersey, and first Sharon Morgan, founder of Our Black Ancestry Foundation in rural Mississippi.
When the Emancipation Proclamation was signed, it did not emancipate everybody. Mm-hmm. It took 3 amendments to the United States Constitution before African Americans were finally truly legal citizens of the United States. So with that in mind, my family story is that in doing the course of my research, I have found almost 24 people who were enslaved on both sides of my family. I concentrate on one of them about whom I'm writing a book. She was taken from her mother at the age of 9 and transported from Virginia to Mississippi, where she was enslaved by a family here and had 17 children with the nephew of the man who owned her. I found the research so compelling, I actually moved here. So I live not far from the plantation where she was enslaved. And I've been able to uncover so much more here because I live near the courthouse. So I found just amazing information that is incredibly emotional for me because I'm right here in her footsteps.
What was her name, Sharon?
Betty Wharf Gavin.
And as you discover these things about Betty, talk me through how that affects you, because we can imagine a 9-year-old girl and then you see the trajectory of her life.
I have a 9-year-old granddaughter, and I don't want to start crying and telling this story, but every time I look at my granddaughter, I think about my 2x great-grandmother, and I cannot imagine that a child of mine could be taken from me and enslaved and be forced to have children, because people would like to romanticize it and say, well, there must have been romance in this relationship with Betty between her and the white father. And I can't see that, because she didn't have any agency. She could never say no. So that says that at least 17 times in her life, she was raped. And it is incredibly emotional to think about those things.
Absolutely, just as we try to digest that as well with you. Let me turn to Bernice, who is listening and also has a story to tell. You also began looking into your family history, and feel free, of course, to pick up on any of the points that Sharon made.
I have family from Louisiana and South Carolina, and I began a journey to just search for my South Carolina kin. And I discovered an ancestor on an inventory. And he was listed along with his parents in 1830. And I found the name of the person that he was listed as a part of this inventory. And the name of that person was Wally Kemp. The inventory listed two Negroes, Dick and Allie, sold to Simpson Mathis, Sam, Patience, and three children sold to George Slappy. And there was a price tag of $1,232. One of those children was my great-grandfather, Andrew. But the inventories continued, because Wally's son, after Wally died, his son then took over the estate, and I found Andrew once again, Negro boy, Andrew, purchased by Caroline Kemp, $286. And then Caroline passed away, and I found Andrew again in 1847, one Negro boy, Andrew, $400. Now, I want to tell you, just saying this right now, I'm shaking. Just mm-hmm. to think that my ancestor is listed along with the furniture, the beds. It is the most difficult document to read. But even more interesting is that not only did I find these documents, but I also connected with the descendant of Henry Johnson Kemp. And so now I am basically looking in the face of a descendant whose family owned my family. Now, we have known each other now since 2004. And what I want to say is that my ancestor Andrew survived. In 1869, Andrew is part of the South Carolina militia. By 1872, he is a juror, and his children are thriving and they're moving forward. And his great-granddaughter, Maddie Kemp, is my grandmother. And so I can say that I know who my ancestors are. I know where he came from. I know where they came from. But I'm definitely standing on the shoulders of my ancestor that survived and continued to support a legacy of our descendants, all of our descendants, because not only did I meet the slave owner descendant, but I also met other cousins that I didn't know. And this is one part of a journey. And I'm continuing to look at all of my ancestors. I found another ancestor, Jack Alexander, who was born in 1810 in Virginia. And his wife, my great-grandmother, was born in 1825 in Virginia. But they were part of the forced migration from Virginia to South Carolina, just as the forced migration from Africa to America. So the journey is there. On my maternal side, I found out from my 105-year-old grandmother that her grandfather owned a lot of land. Think about this. She's 105. Her grandfather was born in 1855. So what do we know? He was not free in 1855. But this man became a landowner. He became a homesteader. And the homestead land was part of a Homestead Act that Abraham Lincoln signed in 1862. He was able to get land, 159.33 acres of land in Louisiana. And so any story that I'm saying to you, I've also chosen to write them in books because I feel that if we're going to do something, we must leave a legacy. We must tell our ancestors' story. We must tell those stories so that those that come behind us will know about resilience, survival, and they know that they all had a dream. And the dream was that they would be free and exercise their freedom, learn how to read, which was extremely important, own land, practice their religion, get paid for the work that they did. I mean, this was all a part mm-hmm. of what freedom meant to my ancestors. And I have many more stories, but this is just a bit of what's going on with me and my life and my research.
I have to say, I'm just pulled in and captivated by the stories that you tell because it's so recent, you know, when you put out those dates of your ancestors, really quite something. I want to turn to Shonda because I understand you began researching just a number of years ago and it was because your grandmother was ill.
Yes, she was diagnosed with cancer. And the biggest thing is that she always talked about growing up in the South in Georgia. And she had a favorite brother and she hadn't spoken to him in years and she didn't know how to get in contact with him just to let him know that essentially she was going to die. I found her brother. He was sitting on maybe 5 to 7 acres of land that had been passed down through sharecropping and other things. But that really sparked me on a journey where I felt like, what can I offer to my kids when they do their school projects about family history? And so I worked with my husband and told him that it was important to me. And by the end of the evening, he was like, look, I set up something for you on ancestry.com. I'm starting your family tree for you. I put your name, my name, the kids. Just put your mom in and keep going and see what you can find. And it came to the place where I found my third great grandmother. And her name was Hannah Ratney Abrams. The family had already had pictures of her, had talked about her for a long time, had this story of slavery and who they thought owned her, but they weren't quite sure. And upon looking at the U.S. Census records, doing a little extra research, I was able to find Hannah on those pages in census records and in the books of other people. And the one thing that I found that stood out, I found a deed for her. 1844, Edward Covington was writing a deed for his niece, Sarah Ann Culliver. He leaves to his niece and to her heirs, for their own benefit, use, and profit, one certain yellow Negro girl, about 11 years old, named Hannah, to have and to hold that said Negro girl, Hannah, and her increase to their own proper use, benefit, and behalf. What does that mean? In layman's terms, they were deeding away my third great grandmother at 11 years old. Not only her away, but any children that she would soon bear. They were deeding their lives away before they even came into existence for the duration of their life. And so he deeds her away as a wedding gift, but Sarah doesn't actually get married until 4 years later. And so Edward holds on to Hannah for 4 years. And the kicker is that Edward Covington is Hannah's father. He is not only her slave owner, but he is her father, and he deeds her away to his niece. And his niece's husband now becomes the slave owner of Hannah at 15 years old. And from there, he proceeds to have 4 children with Hannah, some of which were born around or exactly at the same time as his wife, Sarah, is pregnant or giving birth.
I'm just trying to also perhaps understand what that must have been like for you, Shonda, as you discover about this young girl.
It was exciting to see her on paper, to know that I had followed a paper trail that still had her etched in history, and she was still there. She couldn't be erased. And so to find her, it was rewarding. It was breathtaking. And then after that excitement dies down, it's very humbling. It's very surreal to think what that must have been like to be born into slavery, to be deeded away at 11, but to see that actually come to pass at 15, where you have to leave your mother, you have to leave your siblings and be pulled away and be sent to the home of someone that you don't truly know. She did not know her husband. She did not know what would become of her. And she, you know, I'm sure in my mind, I think she may have expected that, you know, this is what happens in slavery. We get raped and things like that. But for it to become her reality and her mother not be there and her not to be comforted by anyone, when she was deeded away on this very small plantation, she was the lone slave there with her cousin, Sarah Ann Culliford, and with her cousin's husband.
Her father made that transaction.
Absolutely.
And that is a story that reverberates with all of us who are doing our family histories. We have lost 10 generations of people. When you go through the documents, and it seems like everybody who came out of slavery didn't have any brothers and sisters. Mm-hmm. And that's absolutely not true. Where are those people? In my family, my great-grandmother was alive when I was a child. Her name was Rhody Leslie, and she died when she was 104. And because I was a very small child, I obviously couldn't talk to her and, you know, didn't have that much relationship. She was just the person you hug and you go and visit. And when I realized that she had actually been enslaved and that that was in my lifetime, that made it more compelling for me to do this research, because we are just incredibly strong people to have survived this. And I think our goal as genealogists has been recovering those lost generations and honoring the people who, when they're out in the field picking cotton, they were dreaming of us. They were dreaming of a better day. And we are the fulfillment of those dreams. So we have to go back and we have to find them, name them, honor them. And Juneteenth is an opportunity. It's a focal point day for being able to do that.
Absolutely. Bernice?
Right. Yes, I totally agree with Sharon. But I want to go back to something that was said, and it is the emotions. How it feels when you first discover your ancestor. Initially, there's great joy because you're so happy you have found them. And then reality hits you. I mean, it hits you hard because you now see that your ancestor was owned by somebody. And I want to just keep saying that. They were owned by somebody who had the gall to think that they could own a human being. We can't ever see a society like the United States own human beings. And I think given what's going on in our country today, politically, we need to make Juneteenth a national celebration so that we can all embrace the fact that freedom is for everyone. And I want to say something. I was born without all my freedoms. That's right. I was. Now, my children were born with their freedoms, but with my freedoms, no. There were restrictions on where we could sit on the bus. And I grew up in New Orleans. We had to have a sign that said colored put in front of us. We went to segregated schools. We had a separate beach. Integration was not what it is today.
I grew up in Chicago. We had segregated beaches. We could only live in certain communities. We were redlined by the bank, so you couldn't buy a house. So the continuing travesty of what happened to us goes on until this day when black men and women are being killed in the streets by police because there is a mindset that says that black people are dangerous and that you automatically react in fear when confronted by someone with a black skin. So we're living with these consequences today, and it is the entire country. It is not just the South. And we have to come to terms with that. And the best way to do that is through uncovering the history. And the best way I know of uncovering the history is through the personal stories of our ancestors. It happened to me. It happened to Bernice. It happened to Chandra. It happened to 4 million people who were emancipated by the Emancipation Proclamation.
But there's still a lot more work to be done.
Oh, there's no doubt about that. All of this is coming back up to the forefront. I lived through the civil rights movement. We were able to obtain some civil rights, but I always felt that that quest should have been related to human rights, because part of the awfulness of slavery was the dehumanization, the fact that we were not entitled to every right. Like I said, it took 3 constitutional amendments after Juneteenth, after the Emancipation Proclamation, in order for us to be fully legal citizens. And still, we were frustrated in that desire because there was segregation and you couldn't ride a bus and you couldn't live in certain places. The United States has covered this up and acted like it is doing so well. We have made a lot of progress, but obviously, we have not been able to correct what's in the hearts and minds of people who still believe that black people are less and that we should not be entitled to everything, the full equality that we should be. The issue that I think is important is that white people have to deal with this.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Black people have talked about race forever. The man who lives in our White House has said that he made Juneteenth important because nobody knew about it until him. That is
appalling, yes.
Black people know this. White people have to deal with this. And yeah. I think that's where we are now, is that we can march in the streets, we can raise the alarm, we can say all of these things. But until white people really get down into their souls and really start rethinking how they think about us, it is not going to change.
Extraordinary stories and history there from Sharon Morgan in Mississippi, Bernice Alexander Bennett in Maryland, and Shonda Brooks in New Jersey. Sadly, slavery is still with us, whether it's in the form of forced labor or sex trafficking, with more than 40 million people in slavery around the world. Uncovering slavery's history and the devastating impact it has on people's lives today is far from over. I'm Nuala McGovern, and this has been BBC OS, Conversations About Race in America.
Distribution of the BBC World Service in the U.S. is made possible by American Public Media with support from Noom, a personalized weight loss program based in psychology for helping people change their habits and conquer their goals. Learn more at Noom, N-O-O-M.com. And from X-Chair, dynamic variable lumbar support and 10 ergonomic features designed for maximum support and comfort at xchairradio.com or 844-4XCHAIR.